surrounded by his 8 children, brooding about his approaching death. I feel very sorry for him and hate not being able to go out. Otherwise, I'd visit him as often as I could and help take his mind off matters. Now the good man can no longer let us know what's being said and done in the warehouse, which is a disaster for us. Mr. Foskill was our greatest source of help and support when it came to safety measures. We miss him very much. Next month it's our turn to hand over our radio to the authorities. Mr. Kleiman has a small set hidden in his home that he's given us to replace our beautiful cabinet radio. It's a pity we have to turn in our big Phillips, but when you're in hiding, you can't afford to bring the authorities down on your heads. Of course, we'll put the baby radio upstairs. What's a clandestine radio when there are already clandestine Jews and clandestine money? All over the country, people are trying to get hold of an old radio that they can hand over instead of their morale booster. It's true, as the reports from outside grow worse and worse, the radio, with its wondrous voice, helps us not to lose heart and to keep telling ourselves, "Cheer up, keep your spirits high, things are bound to get better." Yours, Anne. Sunday, July 11th, 1943. Dear Kitty, to get back to the subject of child-rearing for the umpteenth time, let me tell you that I'm doing my best to be helpful, friendly, and kind, and to do all I can to keep the rain of rebukes down to a light drizzle. It's not easy trying to behave like a model child with people you can't stand, especially when you don't mean a word of it. But I can see that a little hypocrisy gets me a lot further than my old method of saying exactly what I think, even though no one ever asks my opinion or cares one way or another. Of course, I often forget my role and find it impossible to curb my anger when they're unfair, so that they spend the next month saying I'm the most impertinent girl in the world. Don't you think I'm to be pitied sometimes? It's a good thing I'm not the grouchy type, because then I might become sour and bad-tempered. I can usually see the humorous side of their scoldings, but it's easier when somebody else is being raked over the coals. Further, I've decided, after a great deal of thought, to drop the shorthand. First, so that I have more time for my other subjects, and second, because of my eyes. That's a sad story. I'd become very nearsighted and should have had glasses ages ago. Ugh, won't I look like a dope? But, as you know, people in hiding can't. Yesterday, all anyone here could talk about was Anne's eyes, because Mother had suggested I go to the ophthalmologist with Mrs. Kleiman. Just hearing this made my knees weak, since it's no small matter. Going outside. Just think of it, walking down the street. I can't imagine it. I was petrified at first, and then glad. But it's not as simple as all that. The various authorities who had to approve such a step were unable to reach a quick decision. They first had to carefully weigh all the difficulties and risks, though Meep was ready to set off immediately with me in tow. In the meantime, I'd taken my gray coat from the closet, but it was so small it looked as if it might have belonged to my little sister. We lowered the hem, but I still couldn't button it. I'm really curious to see what they decide, only I don't think they'll ever work out a plan, because the British have landed in Sicily and Father's all set for a quick finish. Bep's been giving Margot and me a lot of office work to do. It makes us both feel important, and it's a big help to her. Anyone can file letters and make entries in a sales book, but we do it with remarkable accuracy. Meep has so much to carry she looks like a pack mule. She goes forth nearly every day to scrounge up vegetables, and then bicycles back with her purchases in large shopping bags. She's also the one who brings 5 library books with her every Saturday. We long for Saturdays because that means books. We're like a bunch of little kids with a present. Ordinary people don't know how much books can mean to someone who's cooped up. Our only diversions are reading, studying, and listening to the radio. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, July 13th, 1943. The Best Little Table. Yesterday afternoon, Father gave me permission to ask Mr. Dussel whether he would please be so good as to allow me, see how polite I am, to use the table in our room 2 afternoons a week, from 4 to 5:30. I already sit there every day from 2:30 to 4 while Dussel takes a nap, but the rest of the time the room and the table are off limits to me. It's impossible to study next door in the afternoon because there's too much going on. Besides, Father sometimes likes to sit at the desk during the afternoon. So it seems like a reasonable request, and I asked Dussel very politely. What do you think the learned gentleman's reply was? No. Just plain no. I was incensed and wasn't about to let myself be put off like that. I asked him the reason for his no, but this didn't get me anywhere. The gist of his reply was, I have to study too, you know, and if I can't do that in the afternoons, I won't be able to fit it in at all. I have to finish the task I've set for myself, otherwise there's no point in starting. Besides, you aren't serious about your studies. Mythology, what kind of work is that? Reading and knitting don't count either. I use that table, and I'm not going to give it up. I replied, Mr. Dussel, I do take my work seriously. I can't study next door in the afternoons, and I would appreciate it if you would reconsider my request. Having said these words, the insulted Anne turned around and pretended the learned doctor wasn't there. I was seething with rage and felt that Dussel had been incredibly rude, which he certainly had been, and that I'd been very polite. That evening, when I managed to get hold of Pym, I told him what had happened and we discussed what my next step should be, because I had no intention of giving up and preferred to deal with the matter myself. Pym gave me a rough idea of how to approach Dussel, but cautioned me to wait until the next day since I was in such a flap. I ignored this last piece of advice and waited for Dussel after the dishes had been done. Pym was sitting next door, and that had a calming effect. I began, Mr. Dussel, you seem to believe further discussion of the matter is pointless, but I beg you to reconsider. Dussel gave me his most charming smile and said, I'm always prepared to discuss the matter, even though it's already been settled. I went on talking, despite Dussel's repeated interruptions. When you first came here, I said, we agreed that the room was to be shared by the two of us. If we were to divide it fairly, you'd have the entire morning and I'd have the entire afternoon. I'm not asking for that much, but two afternoons a week does seem reasonable to me. Dussel leapt out of his chair as if he'd sat on a pin. You have no business talking about your rights to the room. Where am I supposed to go? Maybe I should ask Mr. Van Den to build me a cubbyhole in the attic. You're not the only one who can't find a quiet place to work. You're always looking for a fight. If your sister Margot, who has more right to workspace than you do, had come to me with the same request, I'd never even have thought of refusing, but you... And once again he brought up the business about the mythology and the knitting, and once again Anne was insulted. However, I showed no sign of it and let Dussel finish. But no, it's impossible to talk to you. You're shamefully self-centered. No one else matters as long as you get your way. I've never seen such a child, but after all is said and done, I'll be obliged to let you have your way, since I don't want people saying later on that Anne Frank failed her exams because Mr. Dussel refused to relinquish his table. He went on and on until there was such a deluge of words I could hardly keep up. For one fleeting moment I thought, him and his lies, I'll smack his ugly mug so hard he'll go bouncing off the wall. But the next moment I thought, calm down, he's not worth getting so upset about. At long last, Mr. Dussel's fury was spent, and he left the room with an expression of triumph mixed with wrath, his coat pockets bulging with food. I went running over to Father and recounted the entire story, or at least those parts he hadn't been able to follow himself. Pym decided to talk to Dussel that very same evening, and they spoke for more than half an hour. They first discussed whether Anne should be allowed to use the table, yes or no. Father said that he and Dussel had dealt with the subject once before, at which time he'd professed to agree with Dussel because he didn't want to contradict the elder in front of the younger, but that, even then, he hadn't thought it was fair. Dussel felt I had no right to talk as if he were an intruder laying claim to everything in sight. But Father protested strongly, since he himself had heard me say nothing of the kind. And so the conversation went back and forth, with Father defending my selfishness and my busy work, and Dussel grumbling the whole time. Dussel finally had to give in, and I was granted the opportunity to work without interruption two afternoons a week. Dussel looked very sullen, didn't speak to me for 2 days, and made sure he occupied the table from 5 to 5:30. All very childish, of course. Anyone who's so petty and pedantic at the age of 54 was born that way and is never going to change. Friday, July 16th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, there's been another break-in, but this time a real one. Peter went down to the warehouse this morning at 7, as usual, and noticed at once that both the warehouse door and the street door were open. He immediately reported this to Pym, who went to the private office, tuned the radio to a German station, and locked the door. Then they both went back upstairs. In such cases, our orders are not to wash ourselves or run any water, to be quiet, to be dressed by 8, and not to go to the bathroom. And as usual, we followed these to the letter. We were all glad we'd slept so well and hadn't heard anything. For a while, we were indignant because no one from the office came upstairs the entire morning. Mr. Kleiman left us on tenterhooks until 11:30. He told us that the burglars had forced the outside door and the warehouse door with a crowbar, but when they didn't find anything worth stealing, they tried their luck on the next floor. They stole 2 cash boxes containing 40 guilders, blank checkbooks, and worst of all, coupons for 330 pounds of sugar, our entire allotment. It won't be easy to wangle new ones. Mr. Kugler thinks this burglar belongs to the same gang as the one who made an unsuccessful attempt 6 weeks ago to open all 3 doors, the warehouse door and the 2 outside doors. The burglary caused another stir, but the annex seems to thrive on excitement. Naturally, we were glad the cash register and the typewriters had been safely tucked away in our clothes closet. Yours, Anne. P.S. Landing in Sicily, another step closer to the... Monday, July 19th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, North Amsterdam was very heavily bombed on Sunday. There was apparently a great deal of destruction. Entire streets are in ruins, and it will take a while for them to dig out all the bodies. So far, there have been 200 dead and countless wounded. The hospitals are bursting at the seams. We've been told of children searching forlornly in the smoldering ruins for their dead parents. It still makes me shiver to think of the dull, distant drone that signified the approaching destruction. Friday, July 23rd, 1943. Bep is currently able to get hold of notebooks, especially journals and ledgers, useful for my bookkeeping sister. Other kinds are for sale as well, but don't ask what they're like or how long they'll last. At the moment, they're all labeled, "No coupons needed." Like everything else you can purchase without ration stamps, they're totally worthless. They consist of 12 sheets of gray paper with narrow lines that slant across the page. Margot is thinking about taking a course in calligraphy. I've advised her to go ahead and do it. Mother won't let me because of my eyes, but I think that's silly. Whether I do that or something else, it all comes down to the same thing. Since you've never been through a war, Kitty, and since you know very little about life in hiding, in spite of my letters, let me tell you, just for fun, what we each want to do first when we're able to go outside again. Margot and Mr. Van Dan wish, above all else, to have a hot bath filled to the brim, which they can lie in for more than half an hour. Mrs. Van Dan would like a cake. Dussel can think of nothing but seeing his Charlotte, and Mother is dying for a cup of real coffee. Father would like to visit Mr. Foskell. Peter would go downtown. And as for me, I'd be so overjoyed I wouldn't know where to begin. Most of all, I long to have a home of our own, to be able to move around freely and have someone help me with my homework again, at last. In other words, to go back to school. Bep has offered to get us some fruit, at so-called bargain prices. Grapes, 2.5 guilders a pound, gooseberries, 70 cents a pound, 1 peach, 50 cents, melons, 75 cents a pound. No wonder the papers write every evening in big fat letters, "Keep prices down." Monday, July 26th, 1943. Dear Kitty, yesterday was a very tumultuous day, and we're still all wound up. Actually, you may wonder if there's ever a day that passes without some kind of excitement. The first warning siren went off in the morning while we were at breakfast, but we paid no attention because it only meant that the planes were crossing the coast. I had a terrible headache, so I lay down for an hour after breakfast and then went to the office at around 2. At 2:30, Margot had finished her office work and was just gathering her things together when the sirens began wailing again. So she and I trooped back upstairs. None too soon, it seems, for less than 5 minutes later the guns were booming so loudly that we went and stood in the hall. The house shook and the bombs kept falling. I was clutching my escape bag, more because I wanted to have something to hold on to than because I wanted to run away. I know we can't leave here, but if we had to, being seen on the streets would be just as dangerous as getting caught in an air raid. After half an hour, the drone of engines faded and the house began to hum with activity again. Peter emerged from his lookout post in the front attic. Dussel remained in the front office. Mrs. Vandy felt safest in the private office. Mr. Van Dan had been watching from the loft, and those of us on the landing spread out to watch the columns of smoke rising from the harbor. Before long, the smell of fire was everywhere, and outside it looked as if the city were enveloped in a thick fog. A big fire like that is not a pleasant sight, but fortunately for us it was all over, and we went back to our various chores. Just as we were starting dinner, another air raid alarm. The food was good, but I lost my appetite the moment I heard the siren. Nothing happened, however, and 45 minutes later the all-clear was sounded. After the dishes had been washed, another air raid warning. Gunfire and swarms of planes. Oh, gosh, twice in one day, we thought. That's twice too many. Little good that did us, because once again the bombs rained down, this time on the other side of the city. According to British reports, Schiphol Airport was bombed. The planes dived and climbed. The air was abuzz with the drone of engines. It was very scary, and the whole time I kept thinking, here it comes, this is it. I can assure you that when I went to bed at 9, my legs were still shaking. At the stroke of midnight, I woke up again. More planes! Dussel was undressing, but I took no notice and leapt up wide awake at the sound of the first shot. I stayed in Father's bed until 1, in my own bed until 1:30, and was back in Father's bed at 2. But the planes kept on coming. At last they stopped firing and I was able to go back home again. I finally fell asleep at 2:30. 7 o'clock. I awoke with a start and sat up in bed. Mr. Van Dan was with Father. My first thought was, burglars. Everything, I heard Mr. Van Dan say, and I thought everything had been stolen. But no, this time it was wonderful news, the best we've had in months, maybe ever since the war began. Mussolini has resigned, and the King of Italy has taken over the government. We jumped for joy. After the awful events of yesterday, finally something good happens and brings us hope. Hope for an end to the war. Hope for peace. Mr. Kugler dropped by and told us that the Fokker aircraft factory had been hit hard. Meanwhile, there was another air raid alarm this morning, with planes flying over and another warning siren. I've had it up to here with alarms. I've hardly slept, and the last thing I want to do is work. But now the suspense about Italy and the hope that the war will be over by the end of the year are keeping us awake. Yours, Anne. Thursday, July 29th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, Mrs. Van Dan, Dussel, and I were doing the dishes, and I was extremely quiet. This is very unusual for me, and they were sure to notice, so in order to avoid any questions, I quickly racked my brains for a neutral topic. I thought the book Henry from Across the Street might fit the bill, but I couldn't have been more wrong. If Mrs. Van Dan doesn't jump down my throat, Mr. Dussel does. It all boiled down to this. Mr. Dussel had recommended the book to Margot and me as an example of excellent writing. We thought it was anything but that. The little boy had been portrayed well, but as for the rest, the less said the better. I mentioned something to that effect while we were doing the dishes, and Dussel launched into a veritable tirade. How can you possibly understand the psychology of a man? That of a child isn't so difficult. But you're far too young to read a book like that. Even a 20-year-old man would be unable to comprehend it. So why did he go out of his way to recommend it to Margot and me? Mrs. Van D. and Dussel continued their harangue. You know way too much about things you're not supposed to. You've been brought up all wrong. Later on, when you're older, you won't be able to enjoy anything anymore. You'll say, oh, I read that 20 years ago in some book. You'd better hurry if you want to catch a husband or fall in love, since everything is bound to be a disappointment to you. You already know all there is to know in theory, but in practice, that's another story. Can you imagine how I felt? I astonished myself by calmly replying, you may think I haven't been raised properly, but many people would disagree. They apparently believe that good child-rearing includes trying to pit me against my parents, since that's all they ever do. And not telling a girl my age about grown-up subjects is fine. We can all see what happens when people are raised that way. At that moment, I could have slapped them both for poking fun at me. I was beside myself with rage, and if I only knew how much longer we had to put up with each other's company, I'd start counting the days. Mrs. Van Dan's a fine one to talk. She sets an example all right. A bad one. She's known to be exceedingly pushy, egotistical, cunning, calculating, and perpetually dissatisfied. Add to that vanity and coquettishness, and there's no question about it. She's a thoroughly despicable person. I could write an entire book about Madame Van Dan, and who knows, maybe someday I will. Anyone can put on a charming exterior when they want to. Mrs. Van D is friendly to strangers, especially men, so it's easy to make a mistake when you first get to know her. Mother thinks that Mrs. Van D is too stupid for words, Margot that she's too unimportant, Pym that she's too ugly, literally and figuratively, and after long observation, I'm never prejudiced at the beginning, I've come to the conclusion that she's all three of the above, and lots more besides. She has so many bad traits, why should I single out just one of them? Yours, Anne. P.S. Will the reader please take into consideration that this story was written before the writer's fury had cooled? Tuesday, August 3rd, 1943. Dearest Kitty, things are going well on the political front. Italy has banned the fascist party. The people are fighting the fascists in many places. Even the army has joined the fight. How can a country like that continue to wage war against England? Our beautiful radio was taken away last week. Dussel was very angry at Mr. Kugler for turning it in on the appointed day. Dussel is slipping lower and lower in my estimation, and he's already below zero. Whatever he says about politics, history, geography, or anything else is so ridiculous that I hardly dare repeat it. Hitler will fade from history. The harbor in Rotterdam is bigger than the one in Hamburg. The English are idiots for not taking the opportunity to bomb Italy to smithereens, etc., etc. We just had a third air raid. I decided to grit my teeth and practice being courageous. Mrs. Van Dan, the one who always said, "Let them fall," and "Better to end with a bang than not to end at all," is the most cowardly one among us. She was shaking like a leaf this morning and even burst into tears. She was comforted by her husband, with whom she recently declared a truce after a week of squabbling. I nearly got sentimental at the sight. Mushi has now proved, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that having a cat has disadvantages as well as advantages. The whole house is crawling with fleas, and it's getting worse each day. Mr. Kleiman sprinkled yellow powder in every nook and cranny, but the fleas haven't taken the slightest notice. It's making us all very jittery. We're forever imagining a bite on our arms and legs or other parts of our bodies, so we leap up and do a few exercises, since it gives us an excuse to take a better look at our arms or necks. But now we're paying the price for having had so little physical exercise. We're so stiff we can hardly turn our heads. The real calisthenics fell by the wayside long ago. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, August 4th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, now that we've been in hiding for a little over a year, you know a great deal about our lives. Still, I can't possibly tell you everything, since it's all so different compared to ordinary times and ordinary people. Nevertheless, to give you a closer look into our lives, from time to time I'll describe part of an ordinary day. I'll start with the evening and night. 9 in the evening. Bedtime always begins in the annex with an enormous hustle and bustle. Chairs are shifted, beds pulled out, blankets unfolded. Nothing stays where it is during the daytime. I sleep on a small divan, which is only 5 feet long, so we have to add a few chairs to make it longer. Comforter, sheets, pillows, blankets, everything has to be removed from Dussel's bed, where it's kept during the day. In the next room, there's a terrible creaking. That's Margot's folding bed being set up. More blankets and pillows, anything to make the wooden slats a bit more comfortable. Upstairs, it sounds like thunder, but it's only Mrs. Van D's bed being shoved against the window so that Her Majesty, arrayed in her pink bed jacket, can sniff the night air through her delicate little nostrils. 9 o'clock. After Peter's finished, it's my turn for the bathroom. I wash myself from head to toe, and more often than not, I find a tiny flea floating in the sink. Only during the hot months, weeks, or days. I brush my teeth, curl my hair, manicure my nails, and dab peroxide on my upper lip to bleach the black hairs. All this in less than half an hour. 9:30. I throw on my bathrobe. With soap in one hand and potty, hairpins, panties, curlers, and a wad of cotton in the other, I hurry out of the bathroom. The next in line invariably calls me back to remove the gracefully curved but unsightly hairs that I've left in the sink. 10 o'clock. Time to put up the blackout screen and say goodnight. For the next 15 minutes, at least, the house is filled with the creaking of beds and the sigh of broken springs. And then, provided our upstairs neighbors aren't having a marital spat in bed, all is quiet. 11:30. The bathroom door creaks. A narrow strip of light falls into the room. Squeaking shoes. A large coat. Even larger than the man inside it. Dussel is returning from his nightly work in Mr. Kugler's office. I hear him shuffling back and forth for 10 whole minutes. The rustle of paper from the food he's tucking away in his cupboard, and the bed being made up. Then the figure disappears again, and the only sound is the occasional suspicious noise from the bathroom. Approximately 3 o'clock. I have to get up to use the tin can under my bed, which, to be on the safe side, has a rubber mat underneath in case of leaks. I always hold my breath while I go, since it clatters into the can like a brook down a mountainside. The potty is returned to its place, and the figure in the white nightgown, the one that causes Margot to exclaim every evening, "Oh, that indecent nightie," climbs back into bed. A certain somebody lies awake for about 15 minutes, listening to the sounds of the night. In the first place, to hear whether there are any burglars downstairs, and then to the various beds, upstairs, next door, and in my room, to tell whether the others are asleep or half awake. This is no fun, especially when it concerns a member of the family named Dr. Dussel. First, there's the sound of a fish gasping for air, and this is repeated 9 or 10 times. Then the lips are moistened profusely. This is alternated with little smacking sounds, followed by a long period of tossing and turning and rearranging the pillows. After 5 minutes of perfect quiet, the same sequence repeats itself 3 more times, after which he's presumably lulled himself back to sleep for a while. Sometimes the guns go off during the night, between 1 and 4. I'm never aware of it before it happens, but all of a sudden I find myself standing beside my bed out of sheer habit. Occasionally I'm dreaming so deeply of irregular French verbs or a quarrel upstairs that I realize only when my dream is over that the shooting has stopped and that I've remained quietly in my room. But usually I wake up. Then I grab a pillow and a handkerchief, throw on my robe and slippers, and dash next door to Father, just the way Margot described in this birthday poem. When shots ring out in the dark of night, the door creaks open, and into sight come a hanky, a pillow, a figure in white. Once I've reached the big bed, the worst is over, except when the shooting is extra loud. 6:45, bring! The alarm clock, which raises its shrill voice at any hour of the day or night, whether you want it to or not. Creak, wham, Mrs. Van D turns it off. Squeak, Mr. Van D gets up, puts on the water, and races to the bathroom. 7:15. The door creaks again. Dussel can go to the bathroom. Alone at last, I remove the blackout screen. And a new day begins in the annex. Yours, Anne. Thursday, August 5th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, today let's talk about the lunch break. It's 12:30. The whole gang breathes a sigh of relief. Mr. Van Maren, the man with the shady past, and Mr. De Kock have gone home for lunch. Upstairs, you can hear the thud of the vacuum cleaner on Mrs. Vandy's beautiful and only rug. Margot tucks a few books under her arm and heads for the class for slow learners, which is what Dussel seems to be. Pim goes and sits in a corner with his constant companion, Dickens, in hopes of finding a bit of peace and quiet. Mother hastens upstairs to help the busy little housewife, and I tidy up both the bathroom and myself at the same time. 12:45. One by one, they trickle in. First Mr. Geese, and then either Mr. Kleiman or Mr. Kugler, followed by Bep and sometimes even Meep. 1. Clustered around the radio, they all listen raptly to the BBC. This is the only time the members of the Annex family don't interrupt each other, since even Mr. Van Dan can't argue with the speaker. 1:15. Food distribution. Everyone from downstairs gets a cup of soup, plus dessert, if there happens to be any. A contented Mr. Geese sits on the divan or leans against the desk with his newspaper, cup, and usually the cat at his side. If one of the three is missing, he doesn't hesitate to let his protest be heard. Mr. Kleiman relates the latest news from town, and he's an excellent source. Mr. Kugler hurries up the stairs, gives a short but solid knock on the door, and comes in either wringing his hands or rubbing them in glee, depending on whether he's quiet and in a bad mood or talkative and in a good mood. 1:45. Everyone rises from the table and goes about their business. Margot and Mother do the dishes, Mr. and Mrs. Van D head for the divan, Peter for the attic, Father for his divan, Dussel too, and Anne does her homework. What comes next is the quietest hour of the day, when they're all asleep. There are no disturbances. To judge by his face, Dussel is dreaming of food. But I don't look at him long because the time whizzes by, and before you know it, it'll be 4 p.m. and the pedantic Dr. Dussel will be standing with the clock in his hand because I'm 1 minute late clearing off the table. Yours, Anne. Saturday, August 7th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, a few weeks ago I started writing a story, something I made up from beginning to end, and I've enjoyed it so much that the products of my pen are piling up. Yours, Anne. Monday, August 9th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, we now continue with a typical day in the annex. Since we've already had lunch, it's time to describe dinner. Mr. Van Dam is served first and takes a generous portion of whatever he likes. Usually joins in the conversation, never fails to give his opinion. Once he's spoken, his word is final. If anyone dares to suggest otherwise, Mr. Van D can put up a good fight. Oh, he can hiss like a cat. But I'd rather he didn't. Once you've seen it, you never want to see it again. His opinion is the best. He knows the most about everything. Granted, the man has a good head on his shoulders, but it's swelled to no small degree. Madame. Actually, the best thing would be to say nothing. Some days, especially when a foul mood is on the way, her face is hard to read. If you analyze the discussions, you realize she's not the subject, but the guilty party. A fact everyone prefers to ignore. Even so, you could call her the instigator, stirring up trouble. Now that's what Mrs. Van Dam calls fun, stirring up trouble between Mrs. Frank and Anne. Margot and Mr. Frank aren't quite as easy. But let's return to the table. Mrs. Van D may think she doesn't always get enough, but that's not the case. The choicest potatoes, the tastiest morsel, the tenderest bit of whatever there is, that's Madame's motto. The others can all have their turn as long as I get the best. Exactly what she accuses Anne Frank of doing. Her second watchword is, keep talking. As long as somebody's listening, it doesn't seem to occur to her to wonder whether they're interested. She must think that whatever Mrs. Van Dam says will interest everyone. Smile coquettishly, pretend you know everything, offer everyone a piece of advice, and mother them. That's sure to make a good impression. But if you take a better look, the good impression fades. 1. She's hardworking. 2. Cheerful. 3. Coquettish. And sometimes a cute face. That's Petronella Van Dam. The third diner says very little. Young Mr. Van Dam is usually quiet and hardly makes his presence known. As far as his appetite is concerned, he's a Danaidian vessel that never gets full. Even after the most substantial meal, he can look you calmly in the eye and claim he could have eaten twice as much. Number 4. Margot. Eats like a bird and doesn't talk at all. She eats only vegetables and fruit. Spoiled, in the opinion of the Van Dams. Too little exercise and fresh air, in ours. Beside her, Mama. Has a hearty appetite, does her share of the talking. No one has the impression, as they do with Mrs. Van Dam, that this is a housewife. What's the difference between the two? Well, Mrs. Van D does the cooking, and Mother does the dishes and polishes the furniture. Numbers 6 and 7. I won't say much about Father and me. The former is the most modest person at the table. He always looks to see whether the others have been served first. He needs nothing for himself. The best things are for the children. He's goodness personified. Seated next to him is the annex's little bundle of nerves.
Dussel.
Help yourself, keep your eyes on the food, eat and don't talk, and if you have to say something, then for goodness sake, talk about food. That doesn't lead to quarrels, just to bragging. He consumes enormous portions, and no is not part of his vocabulary, whether the food is good or bad. Pants that come up to his chest, a red jacket, black patent leather slippers, and horn-rimmed glasses. That's how he looks when he's at work at the little table, always studying and never progressing. This is interrupted only by his afternoon nap, food, and his favorite spot, the bathroom. 3, 4, or 5 times a day, there's bound to be someone waiting outside the bathroom door, hopping impatiently from one foot to another, trying to hold it in and barely managing. Does Dussel care? Not a whit. From 7:15 to 7:30, from 12:30 to 1, from 2 to 2:15, from 4 to 4:15, from 6 to 6:15, from 11:30 to 12. You can set your watch by them. These are the times for his regular sessions. He never deviates or lets himself be swayed by the voices outside the door, begging him to open up before a disaster occurs. Number 9 is not part of our annex family, Although she does share our house and table, Bep has a healthy appetite. She cleans her plate and isn't choosy. Bep's easy to please, and that pleases us. She can be characterized as follows: cheerful, good-humored, kind, and willing. Tuesday, August 10th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, a new idea. During meals, I talk more to myself than to the others, which has two advantages. First, they're glad they don't have to listen to my continuous chatter. And second, I don't have to get annoyed by their opinions. I don't think my opinions are stupid, but other people do, so it's better to keep them to myself. I apply the same tactic when I have to eat something I loathe. I put the dish in front of me, pretend it's delicious, avoid looking at it as much as possible, and it's gone before I've had time to realize what it is. When I get up in the morning, another very disagreeable moment, I leap out of bed, think to myself, "You'll be slipping back under the covers soon." Walk to the window, take down the blackout screen, sniff at the crack until I feel a bit of fresh air and I'm awake. I strip the bed as fast as I can so I won't be tempted to get back in. Do you know what Mother calls this sort of thing? The art of living. Isn't that a funny expression? We've all been a little confused this past week because our dearly beloved Vester Tora bells have been carted off to be melted down for the war, so we have no idea of the exact time, either night or day. I still have hopes that they'll come up with a substitute, made of tin or copper or some such thing, to remind the neighborhood of the clock. Everywhere I go, upstairs or down, they all cast admiring glances at my feet, which are adorned by a pair of exceptionally beautiful, for times like these, shoes. Meep managed to snap them up for 27.5 guilders. Burgundy-colored suede and leather with medium-sized high heels. I feel as if I'm on stilts and look even taller than I already am. Yesterday was my unlucky day. I pricked my right thumb with the blunt end of a big needle. As a result, Margot had to peel potatoes for me, take the good with the bad, and writing was awkward. Then I bumped into the cupboard door so hard it nearly knocked me over and was scolded for making such a racket. They wouldn't let me run water to bathe my forehead, so now I'm walking around with a giant lump over my right eye. To make matters worse, the little toe on my right foot got stuck in the vacuum cleaner. It bled and hurt, but my other ailments were already causing me so much trouble that I let this one slide, which was stupid of me, because now I'm walking around with an infected toe. What with the salve, the gauze, and the tape, I can't get my heavenly new shoe on my foot. Dussel has put us in danger for the umpteenth time. He actually had Meep bring him a book, an anti-Mussolini tirade which has been banned. On the way here, she was knocked down by an SS motorcycle. She lost her head and shouted, "You brutes!" and went on her way. I don't dare think what would have happened if she'd been taken down to headquarters. Yours, Anne. A daily chore in our little community. Peeling potatoes. One person goes to get some newspapers. Another, the knives. Keeping the best for himself, of course. The third, the potatoes, and the fourth, the water. Mr. Dussel begins. He may not always peel them very well, but he does peel non-stop, glancing left and right to see if everyone is doing it the way he does. No, they're not. "Look, Anne, I am taking peeler in my hand like so and going from the top to bottom. 9, not so, but so." "I think my way is easier, Mr. Dussel," I say tentatively. "But this is best way, Anne. This you can take from me. Of course, it is no matter. You do the way you want." We go on peeling. I glance at Dussel out of the corner of my eye. Lost in thought, he shakes his head. Over me, no doubt, but says no more. I keep on peeling. Then I look at Father, on the other side of me. To Father, peeling potatoes is not a chore, but precision work. When he reads, he has a deep wrinkle in the back of his head. But when he's preparing potatoes, beans, or vegetables, he seems to be totally absorbed in his task. He puts on his potato-peeling face, and when it's set in that particular way, it would be impossible for him to turn out anything less than a perfectly peeled potato. I keep on working. I glance up for a second, but that's all the time I need. Mrs. Van D is trying to attract Dussel's attention. She starts by looking in his direction, but Dussel pretends not to notice. She winks, but Dussel goes on peeling. She laughs, but Dussel still doesn't look up. Then Mother laughs too, but Dussel pays them no mind. Having failed to achieve her goal, Mrs. Van D is obliged to change tactics. There's a brief silence. Then she says, Pootie, why don't you put on an apron? Otherwise, I'll have to spend all day tomorrow trying to get the spots out of your suit.
I'm not getting it dirty.
Another brief silence. Pootie, why don't you sit down?
I'm fine this way. I like standing up.
Silence. Pootie,
look out, du sprich schon.
I know, Mommy, but I'm being careful.
Mrs. Van D casts about for another topic. Tell me, Pootie, why aren't the British carrying out any bombing raids today?
Because the weather's bad, Carolee.
But yesterday it was such nice weather, and they weren't flying then, either.
Let's drop the subject.
Why, can't a person talk about that or offer an opinion?
No.
Well, why in the world not?
Oh, be quiet, Mamashin.
Mr. Frank always answers his wife.
Mr. Van D is trying to control himself. This remark always rubs him the wrong way, but Mrs. Van D is not one to quit.
Oh, there's never going to be an invasion.
Mr. Van D turns white, and when she notices it, Mrs. Van D turns red. But she's not about to be deterred.
The British aren't doing a thing.
The bomb bursts, and now shut up, Donnerwetter nochmal. Mother can barely stifle a laugh, and I stare straight ahead. Scenes like these are repeated almost daily, unless they've just had a terrible fight. In that case, neither Mr. nor Mrs. Van D says a word. It's time for me to get some more potatoes. I go up to the attic, where Peter is busy picking fleas from the cat. He looks up, the cat notices it, and whoosh, he's gone. Out the window and into the rain gutter. Peter swears. I laugh and slip out of the room. Freedom in the Annex. 5:30. Bep's arrival signals the beginning of our nightly freedom. Things get going right away. I go upstairs with Bep, who usually has her dessert before the rest of us. The moment she sits down, Mrs. Van D begins stating her wishes. Her list usually starts with, Oh, by the way, Bep, something else I'd like. Bep winks at me. Mrs. Van D doesn't miss a chance to make her wishes known to whoever comes upstairs. It must be one of the reasons none of them like to go up there. 5:45. Bep leaves. I go down two floors to have a look around. First to the kitchen, then to the private office, and then to the coal bin to open the cat door for Mushi. After a long tour of inspection, I wind up in Mr. Kugler's office. Mr. Van Dan is combing all the drawers and files for today's mail. Peter picks up Bosch and the warehouse key. Pim lugs the typewriters upstairs. Margot looks around for a quiet place to do her office work. Mrs. Van D puts a kettle of water on the stove. Mother comes down the stairs with a pan of potatoes. We all know our jobs. Soon Peter comes back from the warehouse. The first question they ask him is whether he's remembered the bread. No, he hasn't. He crouches before the door to the front office to make himself as small as possible and crawls on his hands and knees to the steel cabinet, takes out the bread, and starts to leave. At any rate, that's what he intends to do. But before he knows what's happened, Mushi has jumped over him and gone to sit under the desk. Peter looks all around him. Aha, there's the cat. He crawls back into the office and grabs the cat by the tail. Mushi hisses, Peter sighs. What has he accomplished? Mushi's now sitting by the window licking herself, very pleased at having escaped Peter's clutches. Peter has no choice but to lure her with a piece of bread. Mushi takes the bait, follows him out, and the door closes. I watch the entire scene through a crack in the door. Mr. Van Dan is angry and slams the door. Margot and I exchange looks and think the same thing. He must have worked himself into a rage again because of some blunder on Mr. Kugler's part, and he's forgotten all about the keg company next door. Another step is heard in the hallway. Dussel comes in, goes toward the window with an air of propriety, sniffs, coughs, sneezes, and clears his throat. He's out of luck. It was Pepper. He continues on to the front office. The curtains are open, which means he can't get at his writing paper. He disappears with a scowl. Margot and I exchange another glance. One less page for his sweetheart tomorrow, I hear her say. I nod in agreement. An elephant's tread is heard on the stairway. It's Dussel, seeking comfort in his favorite spot. We continue working. Knock, knock, knock. Three taps means dinner time. Monday, August 23rd, 1943.
Wenn die Uhr halb neun schlägt.
Margot and Mother are nervous.
Shh! Father, be quiet.
Otto, shh!
Pim!
It's 8:30. Come here, you can't run the water anymore. Walk softly. A sample of what's said to father in the bathroom. At the stroke of 8:30, he has to be in the living room. No running water, no flushing toilet, no walking around, no noise whatsoever. As long as the office staff hasn't arrived, sounds travel more easily to the warehouse. The door opens upstairs at 8:20, and this is followed by 3 gentle taps on the floor. Anne's hot cereal. I clamber up the stairs to get my doggy dish. Back downstairs, everything has to be done quickly. Quickly, I comb my hair, put away the potty, shove the bed back in place. Quiet! The clock is striking 8:30. Mrs. Van D changes shoes and shuffles through the room in her slippers. Mr. Van D, too, a veritable Charlie Chaplin. All is quiet. The ideal family scene has now reached its high point. I want to read or study, and Margot does, too. Father and mother ditto. Father is sitting, with Dickens and the dictionary, of course, on the edge of the sagging, squeaky bed, which doesn't even have a decent mattress. 2 bolsters can be piled on top of each other. I don't need these, he thinks. I can manage without them. Once he starts reading, he doesn't look up. He laughs now and then and tries to get mother to read a passage. I don't have the time right now. He looks disappointed, but then continues to read. A little while later, when he comes across another interesting bit, he tries again. You have to read this, mother. Mother sits on the folding bed, either reading, sewing, knitting, or studying, whichever is next on her list. An idea suddenly occurs to her, and she quickly says, so as not to forget, Anne, remember to... Margot, jot this down. After a while, it's quiet again. Margot slams her book shut. Father knits his forehead, his eyebrows forming a funny curve and his wrinkle of concentration reappearing at the back of his head, and he buries himself in his book again. Mother starts chatting with Margot, and I get curious and listen, too. Pim is drawn into the conversation. 9 o'clock. Breakfast. Friday, September 10th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, every time I write to you, something special has happened, usually unpleasant rather than pleasant. This time, however, something wonderful is going on. On Wednesday, September 8th, we were listening to the 7 o'clock news when we heard an announcement. Here is some of the best news of the war so far. Italy has capitulated. Italy has unconditionally surrendered. The Dutch broadcast from England began at 8:15 with the news. Listeners, 1 hour and 15 minutes ago, just as I finished writing my daily report, we received the wonderful news of Italy's capitulation. I tell you, I never tossed my notes into the waste paper basket with more delight than I did today. God Save the King, the American National Anthem, and the Russian Internationale were played. As always, the Dutch program was uplifting without being too optimistic. The British have landed in Naples. Northern Italy is occupied by the Germans. The truce was signed on Friday, September 3rd, the day the British landed in Italy. The Germans are ranting and raving in all the newspapers at the treachery of Badoglio and the Italian king. Still, there's bad news as well. It's about Mr. Kleiman. As you know, we all like him very much. He's unfailingly cheerful and amazingly brave, despite the fact that he's always sick and in pain and can't eat much or do a lot of walking. When Mr. Kleiman enters a room, the sun begins to shine, Mother said recently, and she's absolutely right. Now it seems he has to go to the hospital for a very difficult operation on his stomach and will have to stay there for at least 4 weeks. You should have seen him when he told us goodbye. He acted so normally, as though he were just off to do an errand. Yours, Anne. Thursday, September 16th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, relationships here in the annex are getting worse all the time. We don't dare open our mouths at mealtime, except to slip in a bite of food, because no matter what we say, someone is bound to resent it or take it the wrong way. Mr. Foskell occasionally comes to visit us. Unfortunately, he's not doing very well. He isn't making it any easier for his family, because his attitude seems to be, what do I care? I'm going to die anyway. When I think how touchy everyone is here, I can just imagine what it must be like at the Foskells. I've been taking valerian every day to fight the anxiety and depression, but it doesn't stop me from being even more miserable the next day. A good hearty laugh would help more than 10 valerian drops, but we've almost forgotten how to laugh. Sometimes I'm afraid my face is going to sag with all this sorrow, and that my mouth is going to permanently droop at the corners. The others aren't doing any better. Everyone here is dreading the great terror known as winter. Another fact that doesn't exactly brighten up our day is that Mr. Van Maren, the man who works in the warehouse, is getting suspicious about the annex. A person with any brains must have noticed by now that Meep sometimes says she's going to the lab, Bep to the file room, and Mr. Kleiman to the Opetka supplies, while Mr. Kugler claims the annex doesn't belong to this building at all, but to the one next door. We wouldn't care what Mr. Van Maren thought of the situation, except that he's known to be unreliable and to possess a high degree of curiosity. He's not one who can be put off with a flimsy excuse. One day, Mr. Kugler wanted to be extra cautious, so at 12:20, he put on his coat and went to the drugstore around the corner. Less than 5 minutes later, he was back, and he sneaked up the stairs like a thief to visit us. At 1:15, he started to leave. But Bep met him on the landing and warned him that Van Maren was in the office. Mr. Kugler did an about-face and stayed with us until 1:30. Then he took off his shoes and went in his stocking feet, despite his cold, to the front attic and down the other stairway, taking one step at a time to avoid the creaks. It took him 15 minutes to negotiate the stairs, but he wound up safely in the office after having entered from the outside. In the meantime, Bep had gotten rid of Van Maren and come to get Mr. Kugler from the annex. But he'd already left, and at that moment was still tiptoeing down the stairs. What must the passers-by have thought when they saw the manager putting on his shoes outside? Hey, you, there, in the socks. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, September 29th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, it's Mrs. Van Dan's birthday. Other than one ration stamp each for cheese, meat, and bread, all she received from us was a jar of jam. Her husband, Dussel, and the office staff gave her nothing but flowers and also food. Such are the times we live in. Bep had a nervous fit last week because she had so many errands to do. 10 times a day people were sending her out for something, each time insisting she go right away or go again or that she'd done it all wrong. And when you think that she has her regular office work to do, that Mr. Kleiman is sick, that Meep is home with a cold, and that Bep herself has a sprained ankle, boyfriend troubles, and a grouchy father, it's no wonder she's at the end of her tether. We comforted her and told her that if she'd put her foot down once or twice and say she didn't have the time, the shopping list would shrink of their own accord. Saturday, there was a big drama, the likes of which have never been seen here before. It started with a discussion of Van Maren and ended in a general argument and tears. Dussel complained to Mother that he was being treated like a leper, that no one was friendly to him, and that, after all, he hadn't done anything to deserve it. This was followed by a lot of sweet talk, which luckily Mother didn't fall for this time. She told him we were disappointed in him, and that, on more than one occasion, he'd been a source of great annoyance. Dussel promised her the moon, but, as usual, we haven't seen so much as a beam. There's trouble brewing with the Van Dans, I can tell. Father's furious because they're cheating us. They've been holding back meat and other things. Oh, what kind of bombshell is about to burst now? If only I weren't so involved in all these skirmishes. If only I could leave here. They're driving us crazy. Yours, Anne. Sunday, October 17th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, Mr. Kleiman is back, thank goodness. He looks a bit pale, and yet he cheerfully set off to sell some clothes for Mr. Van Dan. The disagreeable fact is that Mr. Van Dan has run out of money. He lost his last 100 guilders in the warehouse, which is still creating trouble for us. The men are wondering how 100 guilders could wind up in the warehouse on a Monday morning. Suspicion abounds. Meanwhile, the 100 guilders have been stolen. Who's the thief? But I was talking about the money shortage. Mrs. Van D has scads of dresses, coats, and shoes, none of which she feels she can do without. Mr. Van D's suit is difficult to sell, and Peter's bike was put on the block, but is back again since nobody wanted it. But the story doesn't end there. You see, Mrs. Van D is going to have to part with her fur coat. In her opinion, the firm should pay for our upkeep, but that's ridiculous. They just had a flaming row about it and have entered the, oh, my sweet pootie, and darling Carolee stage of reconciliation. My mind boggles at the profanity this honorable house has had to endure in the past month. Father walks around with his lips pressed together, and whenever he hears his name, he looks up in alarm, as if he's afraid he'll be called upon to resolve another delicate problem. Mother's so wrought up, her cheeks are blotched with red. Margot complains of headaches. Dussel can't sleep. Mrs. Van D frets and fumes all day long. And I've gone completely round the bend. To tell you the truth, I sometimes forget who we're at odds with and who we're not. The only way to take my mind off it is to study, and I've been doing a lot of that lately. Yours, Anne. Friday, October 29th, 1943. My dearest Kitty, Mr. Kleiman is out again. His stomach won't give him a moment's peace. He doesn't even know whether it stopped bleeding. He came to tell us he wasn't feeling well and was going home, and for the first time he seemed really down. Mr. and Mrs. Van D have had more raging battles. The reason is simple. They're broke. They wanted to sell an overcoat and a suit of Mr. Van D's, but were unable to find any buyers. His prices were way too high. Some time ago, Mr. Kleiman was talking about a furrier he knows. This gave Mr. Van D the idea of selling his wife's fur coat. It's made of rabbit skin, and she's had it for 17 years. Mrs. Van D got 325 guilders for it, an enormous amount. She wanted to keep the money herself to buy new clothes after the war, and it took some doing before Mr. Van D could make her understand that it was desperately needed to cover household expenses. You can't imagine the screaming, shouting, stamping of feet, and swearing that went on. It was terrifying. My family stood holding its breath at the bottom of the stairs, in case it might be necessary to drag them apart. All the bickering, tears, and nervous tension have become such a stress and strain that I fall into my bed at night, crying and thanking my lucky stars that I have half an hour to myself. I'm doing fine, except I've got no appetite. I keep hearing, "Goodness, you look awful!" I must admit, they're doing their best to keep me in condition. They're plying me with dextrose, cod liver oil, brewer's yeast, and calcium. My nerves often get the better of me, especially on Sundays. That's when I really feel miserable. The atmosphere is stifling, sluggish, leaden. Outside, you don't hear a single bird, and a deathly, oppressive silence hangs over the house and clings to me as if it were going to drag me into the deepest regions of the underworld. At times like these, Father, Mother, and Margot don't matter to me in the least. I wander from room to room, climb up and down the stairs, and feel like a songbird whose wings have been ripped off and who keeps hurling itself against the bars of its dark cage. "Let me out where there's fresh air and laughter," a voice within me cries. I don't even bother to reply anymore, but lie down on the divan. Sleep makes the silence and the terrible fear go by more quickly. Helps pass the time, since it's impossible to kill it. Yours, Anne. Saturday, October 30th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, Mother's nerves are very much on edge, and that doesn't bode well for me. Is it just a coincidence that Father and Mother never scold Margot and always blame me for everything? Last night, for example, Margot was reading a book with beautiful illustrations. She got up and put the book aside for later. I wasn't doing anything, so I picked it up and began looking at the pictures. Margot came back, saw her book in my hands, knitted her brow, and angrily demanded the book back. I wanted to look through it some more. Margot got madder by the minute, and Mother butted in. "Margot was reading that book. Give it back to her." Father came in, and without even knowing what was going on, saw that Margot was being wronged and lashed out at me. "I'd like to see what you'd do if Margot was looking at one of your books." I promptly gave in, put the book down, and, according to them, left the room in a huff. I was neither huffy nor cross, but merely sad. It wasn't right of Father to pass judgment without knowing what the issue was. I would have given the book to Margot myself, and a lot sooner, if Father and Mother hadn't intervened and rushed to take Margot's part as if she were suffering some great injustice. Of course, Mother took Margot's side. They always take each other's sides. I'm so used to it that I've become completely indifferent to Mother's rebukes and Margot's moodiness. I love them, but only because they're Mother and Margot. I don't give a darn about them as people. As far as I'm concerned, they can go jump in a lake. It's different with Father. When I see him being partial to Margot, approving Margot's every action, praising her, hugging her, I feel a gnawing ache inside because I'm crazy about him. I model myself after Father, and there's no one in the world I love more. He doesn't realize that he treats Margot differently than he